Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Jimmy Shin talks about going to law school and being a drug dealer at the same time.
Up until this point, I was a studious, law student, doing all the right things. But I was living that deep of a double life to where, I was like dealing drugs on one end, partying, raving, taking, ecstasy, doing coke with strippers, and plus going to law school. I'm selling drugs, and it got bigger when I went to San Diego because back then the weed was illegal.
Today on the show, comedian Jimmy Shin talks about going to law school while dealing drugs, then getting busted, and how he found his way to sobriety and a successful career as a comedian. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Jimmy Shin, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week with Stuart J. Zully. Stuart is so great. I'm so happy he was on the show. He tells the story about working as a vendor in Yankee Stadium for 40 years, which is right off the bat insane. But he's an actor. And so while he was, working as a vendor all these years, that was kind of his real gig. And then he would do acting stuff on the side. And he's actually done quite a few films. It's very impressive. But anyway, he talks about one night after the Yankees won the championship and how basically he, as a vendor and some of the other vendors and the cops, like the security people, we're there at the stadium. It's like 2 a.m, 3 a.m, and they got to run the bases at Yankee Stadium, plus drink beers and, smoking cigars. And anyway, it was like a magical night for him. And it was a great story. So go back, you guys, listen to Stuart J. Zully. By the way, the last name is Zully, Z-U-L-L-Y. And the only thing I wish I had mentioned or asked him at the end of the show, I should have said, I'm such a goof. I should have said, hey, Stuart, one more question. What was it like when you landed that plane on the Hudson? Wouldn't that have been funny, Jimmy? Come on, that's funny.
Yeah, I didn't know if I was supposed to laugh out loud.
Well, please do. You're with me. Go back, listen to Stuart, but not now, because I have a really fabulous guy here today. He's comedian Jimmy Shin, and I just met him a couple weeks ago doing his podcast called Second Chances. And I met him through Greg Baldwin, who he's such a good guy, right, Jimmy?
Yeah. He's my best friend and he's an amazing good guy for sure.
I mean, I feel like you two together are just a great team. And I do know your past together because I did hear a little bit. I listened to the Second Chances podcast, of course. And I also saw you guys live down the street doing a gig with Bill Burr, which is like, wow, that was exciting. And then I met you there briefly as well. But anyway, nonetheless, I know a lot of comedians. I know you know a lot of comedians. And it's nice that we're finally doing this together. So that's awesome. Well, I've read a lot about you, of course. And I know that you've been doing a lot of sold out shows. And I think that's just so exciting. You're getting great comics on your show, like Eliza Schlesinger was on. You also had my girlfriend on, Kelly Spillman. She's a great girl.
Yeah, she was amazing. Yeah, very funny.
Isn't she something? I know. Very natural. She's a comedian from Atlanta. But anyway, so today you bring forth the topic, law school bust. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell you, Jimmy, you're not the first comedian I've had on the show that went to law school. Have you ever noticed that?
Oh, wow. Which other comedian?
Well, there's several, actually, other comedians. Of course, now I'm going to have to think about it. But truly, there are just I'll have to go back and start now. Look at Gail Thomas there, one off the top of my head. Gail Thomas.
Oh, cool.
Another girl, Liz. Oh, I can't remember. And then, I know another guy, Matt Ritter. You know Matt Ritter?
I don't.
Anyway, comics. And I just always find that fascinating. And not just that you went through all the education and that you went through all the hoops to get the degree you did, but then, you know, that you just, it just goes away. Your desire to do law goes away, or, you know, we're going to hear your story in a second, but I know yours is called Law School Bust. My sister's a lawyer. She went through law school, but I just remember her studying a lot. I don't remember anything else about her going through law school.
Right.
But to me, it just sounds like a pure nightmare.
Yeah. Well, if it's not your path, then it's a pure nightmare. You know, I think if you're doing anything and you're not on your path and you're not living your truth, it's going to be a nightmare in one way or another. And mine, you know, sort of acted out in other exciting ways, which we'll definitely talk about here.
Yeah, we will talk about it. I was a terrible student in college, but I knew to get through. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I was 17 when I started. I graduated at 21. I knew for a fact nobody was ever going to ask me about my college career. I just knew it was important to get the diploma. And it did help me, you know, for the next jobs I had as a flight attendant and as a Peace Corps volunteer, because they would only take college graduates, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and I guess you're going to talk about it in your story, but if not, will you address, I mean, I know you had a lot of pressure from your Korean parents.
Yeah. I was going to talk about that in my story, but yeah, definitely. It was my dad's dream. And like a lot of Asian kids, like if you're not going to become a lawyer, a doctor, or a scientist or engineer, you're nothing, you know? So,
yeah. So is that common in all Asian countries or no, that's just what, I mean, that's so blanketed to say that.
Yeah. I can't speak for all Asian countries, but for sure, Korean Americans, a lot of them sacrifice so much to come to America. And then, you know, and I think that's part of the racism that's going on. You know, a lot of people that are Asian, they focus on education and working hard. And then, you know, we become successful. So, you know, a lot of other races hate on us, you know, just like the Jews. You know?
It's just, yeah, it's just baffling. That the whole racist side of things is baffling to me with all races, mm-hmm. but I'm also well traveled and I know a lot of people. I mean, I know it exists, obviously it exists, mm-hmm. but just this recent Asian hate, it just seems like, what the fuck? Where did that come from?
Yeah. Yeah. I just did a show for Asian hate. And it was a fundraiser, and I put a poster up on my wall on Instagram, and someone commented, "Go back home."
Really?
Yeah. And I was upset, and I looked down, and it was just my mom wanting me to come back home for Mother's Day.
You're so fucking funny, Jimmy.
I let you down there. You went with me.
You had me the whole way. Well, that was a hook, line, and sinker right there. Oh, I'm so soft. But
you should have seen. I wish the listeners could see your face because you look horrified about the racism.
Have you been to Korea?
I have been to Korea, yes.
And when did you go there, as a child or as an adult?
As a child. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't been there in a while. But yeah, I remember it was just very modernized.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I just remember that it was a very much, you know, thriving city because I went to Seoul.
Sure, of course. I have a friend who actually teaches at the university there. He's been living there like 15 years. He loves it. He loves Seoul, Korea.
Yeah. There's a lot of expats there.
Don't you think you would be a huge draw over there?
Probably, but... I don't know. I never wanted to be like a Korean comedian. You know what I mean? I wanted to be an American comedian.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I plan to, when things really open up, to maybe take a tour there.
Yeah.
You know, I never wanted to like just be, you know, in Korea though.
Yeah. That's, I forgot all about that. Nobody did anything. You know, in terms of traveling the last year and a half, we're all just getting back to it. But you should, man. I think you'd kill. I think you'd do great. I'm not talking about living there by any means, but just doing a 2-week tour. It's beautiful. I mean, Thailand is incredible. Oh, yeah. Japan is incredible. I mean, you could do a really neat tour.
Yeah, no, right before the pandemic, actually, we were trying to set something up with China, Thailand, and South Korea, but yeah, and all that happened. So
yeah, I know that you produced a lot of shows, and I also produced a lot of shows, and I don't know about you, but my love of producing shows, which started like 24 years ago, was because I want stage time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what am I going to sit around and wait for somebody to put me on their show? Like TikTok, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Definitely. It started because I wanted to make my own stage and get stage time and be able to trade spots and do all those other benefits. Right. And then, I actually learned to love it and learned that I had a real gift and talent for it, which started in club producing and promoting. You know, it's kind of the same thing. You mm-hmm. know, you create some excitement around your show or event, and, you know, you invite everybody you can. And I'm, you know, ever since I moved here, I would just, you know, always get people's numbers.
Yeah, me too. You know? It's a bottomless pit of comedians. Am I right?
Yeah. It really is.
It's
so many.
Stunning. It's stunning how many people, not just how many comedians there are, but how many walks of life. Because it's like everybody, it's like an artistic choice that at some point or another, everybody made. I guess what I'm saying is it's very tangible. If you become a comedian or you try to be a comedian, it's you got on a stage with nobody else. You know what I mean? Yeah. Everybody starts at the same place.
Yeah. But I sometimes feel like it also chooses you, you know, we choose it, but it also kind of chooses you to where it chases you until it finally gets you.
And I think some of the most interesting or the best comedians are comedians who've lived a life. Yeah. You know what I mean? If you haven't lived a life, like I was lucky enough to get on stage at Gotham Comedy Club a couple of nights ago, name drop. And there was a comic on the show who was a impressionist.
Yeah.
And I just disliked him so goddamn much. I'm sorry. No, I just felt like his impressions were very good. They're very good. But it was just seemed so pompous because he was all just like so confident. And I'm thinking when he got off stage, okay, so he did Trump, he did Bernie, he did, you know, the people in the news. But when you get off stage, I'm thinking, I learned nothing about you. I just think you should be on a different show. I don't know. Is that mean?
No, I like impressionists, actually, because it's a talent that I kind of wish I had more of. I do a little bit, but I think they should definitely include it into a bigger set where they also talk about themselves. But if they do one after another, yeah, you're right. It's hard to get to know them, but I think it's entertaining, you know.
I think
there's room for every kind of comedy. You know, I might not prefer it, but you know, some people love it, you know.
You're very generous.
Yeah, I try to be.
No, but like you know, there's Margaret Cho imitating her mother in an entire scenario, and then there's somebody just doing George Bush from, you know, like 12 years ago. It's like, what are you doing? Like a Clinton impression. Like, stop it. Stop it.
Like, I love it when Daryl Hammond does his Clinton. I love it.
But that's different.
Bigger context.
Famous for it. And he can include it in when I was on Saturday Night Live. You know what I mean? Like, he can include it with a much bigger, he can couch it. Is that the word? Couch it?
Yeah. Yeah, but we all got to hone it in before we can be on Saturday Night Live doing it. You know?
So no, I'm going to do it next week. I get it. No, I get it. Well, anyway, I am very excited to hear your story today, Jimmy, because I know it's going to be a good one. I know that. And before I bring Jimmy on, you guys, I did want to remind you that we are still playing Story Smash virtually on Facebook Live and YouTube every Friday night at 7:00. And the guests have been amazing. In fact, I had on last week Mary Lynn Rice Cub and Greg Proops and Blanka Patch. So we've got some great guests on the show. We're laughing our butts off. Again, it's Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night, 7 p.m. But you better watch it quick. You know why? We're going back to the improv. That's right. There's nothing like a live audience. You know it, and I know it. But Story Smash, you guys, you can also watch past shows over on my YouTube channel, Christine Blackburn. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Jimmy Shin. He is a Los Angeles-based producer and comedian, like we talked about, and an actor. And you've been on The Tonight Show, Jimmy Kimmel, and HBO, and you have your own stand-up special called Jimmy Shin's Walk of Shame, W-O-K. Oh, you're so clever. Jimmy Shin's Walk of Shame. It's really, really fun. I watched it on Amazon Prime. You guys can watch it as well. And you can find out more about Jimmy over at his website, jimmyshindig.com. Very funny, by the way. Shindig. Very funny. And then you can also find Jimmy over on Twitter and Instagram at I am Jimmy Shin. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Jimmy Shin.
Yeah, the story I wanted to tell is about my law school experience and also getting busted selling drugs while I was in law school, which they don't like when you do that. You're supposed to uphold the law and not break it. So yeah, so I'll start from the beginning. You know, ever since I was young, my dad sort of brainwashed me into wanting to become a lawyer. And so I really believed I had a desire to become an attorney. He had a vision board on my wall that said Jimmy Shin, attorney at law. And it even had the legal scales on it that you often see on business cards of attorneys. And yeah, I believed I wanted it. I wake up every day and look at that vision board and go, one day I'm going to become a lawyer. Well, it worked because, you know, I did study hard and I did get straight A's and I did take the SATs and the LSATs and the, you know, everything else that you got to do to get in. And when I got there, I even went to a beautiful campus in San Diego. It's called California Western School of Law. And it was right by the beach. I lived in OB, you know, it was, you know, everybody was stoners and surfers and hippies there. I mean, my people, right?
I never understood how students can study. I mean, I drive by Pepperdine in Malibu and I'm like, how do they do it? I think it's Catholic. Well, anyway, the point is, I think if you go to school at a place like that, like you were in PB, like Pacific Beach, did you say?
In OB.
And which one's that?
More known for is Ocean Beach.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And it's the hippie area, like the, you know, like the stoners and the hippies and just like really fun people. And, no, it was fucking hard. Can I cuss on this?
Yes, please do.
Yeah. It was fucking hard to pull away from, you know, going to the beach, surfing.
The lifestyle.
Yeah. The lifestyle and go back into my, you know, room and start studying things that I was not interested in, you know, at all. And it was like pulling teeth every day, you know what I mean? To listen and to pay attention. I already have ADD like crazy. And you can't fake it in law school, you know, like I've, you know, made my way, you know, kind of faking it to make it, you know, in other words, you know, I would write some shit on my hand sometimes, you know what I mean?
No, yeah.
Do an exam, you know, and cause I was hungover. Right.
Sure. Was your dad checking on you, by the way?
Well, as much as he could, you know, he lived in a whole nother state. So, you know, as far as he knew up until this point, I was a studious, you know, law student, you know, doing all the right things, you know, the angel, right? But I was living that deep of a double life to where, you know, I was like dealing drugs on one end, you know, partying, raving, taking, you know, ecstasy, doing coke with strippers, just, you know, everything on like that. And plus going to law school, going to the law library, you know, looking up stuff on LexisNexis, you know, writing, you know, IRACs, issue, rule, analysis, conclusion, you know, on shit that I cared not, you know, nothing about, right? Some people, you know, have a passion for that stuff. They want to get into, you know, crim law or, you know, do some justice stuff. And I commend them, but it was just not me, you know. I don't know if you've ever, Christine.
Oh, yeah. No, all 4 years of college, I was not interested at all.
Yeah.
But I knew I was just going to get that bachelor's. Where did you do your undergrad, by the way?
At University of Washington in Seattle.
Oh, wow. Another nice place.
Yeah.
But you're from there. You're from there.
Yeah, I'm from there. So, yeah, well, just wanted to go local. Got a scholarship there, so it was easy. Mm-hmm. And but, yeah, no, even being in sunny San Diego, beautiful Ocean Beach, I was miserable. And there was times I remember when I couldn't even get out of bed. You know, I was just so dreading my day, which is so the opposite of what I do these days.
Right, for sure. Yeah. And so day after day, you're going to classes, then you're partying, having a good time, but you're somehow getting through it. And at this point, there's no stand up in your head, right?
No.
Okay.
No, at this point, there's no stand up in my head. I didn't even know that I could do it or it was possible. You know, it was just a pipe dream, you know, that some people that are lucky enough to do. And no, I'm selling drugs, and it got bigger when I went to San Diego, because back then weed was illegal.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know, it was a felony, a misdemeanor or a felony?
It was a felony back then.
Depending on how much.
Yeah. They looked at it like almost, well, they looked at it better than cocaine or ecstasy or crystal, but it was still a felony. And basically I was doing just 100 packs of pound, you know, 100 pounds of weed.
Come on. Is that like a brick? What does that look like?
Well, they call it a 100 pack, but it's they bring it in a giant duffel bag, and you would just see these huge, you know, they look like bricks, but bigger, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, brick is when it's cocaine, but they're huge bags of weed. Like, you would look at it and go, oh my God, that's like a lifetime supply.
And you're living by yourself. You don't have a roommate, right?
I do have a roommate. Yeah. I have a roommate that's like a club DJ. So I'm, you know, DJing clubs on the weekends and getting high and selling drugs and thinking I'm just, you know, Scarface / you know, Johnny Cochran.
And
you know?
Your roommate, he knows about all this?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, he was in on it, right? Mm. And then, yeah, I was just, you know, making lots of money and thinking that I was going to, you know, save up money, open up a big law practice. You know, that
was my
dream, right? And then one day.
That's a hell of a dream. To be doing something illegal and think you're going to take that money, stop doing it, right? That was the idea. Yeah. You were thinking, I'm not doing this forever.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think, you know, many drug dealers do think forever, at least not the smart ones. You know, they know how it ends, right? You know, it always ends in jails, institutions, and death when you're a drug dealer. I don't know very many successful drug dealers.
No, it's a great question. Yeah, I mean, if you quit early enough, but that's completely counterintuitive to drugs.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have one friend who's now a multimillionaire. He put his money into real estate, but he was never an addict. Mm. So I had that extra dimension of, you know, unmanageability.
Doing the product.
He basically did it just for profit and looked at it like a business. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I looked at it like, this is a way for me to get more girls and, you know what I mean?
I bet.
And have more fun. So I'm not going to kill myself because I'm so miserable.
So you're in law school year one, year two, year three?
Year two, I get a knock on my door, and it's 7 DEA agents with guns had confiscated one of my packages from UPS that emanated with weed. I would mail back the money. I told the guy I didn't like mailing back the money, but he goes, just mail it. You know, I do this all the time, right?
Oh, so, my God. What address? Wait, where were you mailing it?
I don't want to say the address.
Okay. Well, fake like it. That. Just say something different. Lie.
Somewhere in Seattle, okay? Somewhere in Seattle.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm not going to name any names or give any addresses or phone numbers at this point. But, yeah, so basically I, you know, would send the money up, and one package – I was stupid enough to put the money in the same safe as the weed, which you should never do if you're going to mail it. And so the dog sniffed it out thinking that there was weed in it. So they came over thinking, you know, with the box unopened, thinking that it was weed. And then, you know, basically they asked me permission because they didn't have a warrant yet. you know, and they kind of tricked me, to be honest. But it was one of those, you know, resentments that you got over because you realized that that was one of the instrumental moments that got you on your path.
Yeah. How much money are we talking about, by the way?
I think I can't remember exactly. I think like 22,000 or something like that.
In
one package. Yeah.
Wow. And this looked like cash.
Yeah, it was cash.
What was the bills? What were they?
Like 20s and hundreds, you know?
Whoa. Okay. So yeah. Now it's in a box. It's in, like you said, a shoebox, or you said a safe.
Well, it was in a safe, and then I would mail it in a box.
Right.
Take it to the UPS store.
Right. And $45 or whatever it costs, and you mail it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So now it's like a federal, you're talking federal offense now because you're dealing with a mail system, right?
No, it wasn't federal for some reason. I think they could have made it, but they saw that I was actually, you know, a good dude just going to law school and sort of lost, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but just the idea that you were in law school breaking the law. I don't know. That's funny.
Yeah. 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 So basically, yeah, they, you know, long story short, I was like handcuffed in my own apartment. All my neighbors come out. They think I'm the studious law student. Back then I have like platinum hair, like, you know, wearing a wife beater, looking like the Asian Eminem.
Was your roommate home that day?
No, he wasn't there that day.
And so
he was there. They took him into the room. Yeah. I found out later on, through the court records, that he actually just turned on me and flipped and just said, yeah, it's all him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's all good. You know,
was that guy in law school too? No way.
No. He was just like,
yeah,
sort of
just a dude.
Yeah. Just a dude that was like into partying, you know?
Okay. Now I've never been taken away in handcuffs by the police, and,
you're missing out, Christine.
Yeah. So tell me what that is. What does that look like? Do they say, go grab your coat, get your cell phone, we're out of here? What do they say?
Well, they don't say any of that. You're just handcuffed and they put it on too tight. And so you're, you know, at the end of it, you have these welts on your hand, and they just treat you like, you know, they're going to, you know, put you in prison forever if you don't tell us what's up. You know what I mean?
Oh God.
Yeah. So, you know, they kind of pressured me after a few hours to, you know, allowing them to go in my safe. You know, I knew that the jig was up. You know, I knew that they had enough evidence to get me for something. They said, we're going to get a warrant anyway, so you might as well do it. Or you want to sit in the handcuffs for another 8 hours while we get a warrant? Or do you want to let us go into the safe? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like thinking, you know what? The jig is up anyway. You know, why even put it off and be in, you know, handcuffs, not eating or drinking, or, you know what I mean?
Let me ask you, where did they take you? To the police station?
Yeah, they took me to the police station. They treated me like a normal felon, man. Strip search, bend over, naked in front of a lineup, you know, washing you off, you know, with a spray. You know what I mean?
Why, like, was there a lineup?
I don't know. But I think to humiliate us is the only thing I can fucking think of, because one of the women police officers or parole officer or whatever she was walked by and kind of hollered at us. It was so fucking, like, you know what I mean? Like, woo!
So
like,
who were you with? You and who? Just other people in jail?
Yeah, other fucking felons, you know, lined up with cholos and like crackheads and like what looked like homeless people.
Yeah. And these are the people they had like kind of just collected that day, or as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. That was in the lockup.
I see. And so now you're all going to be, yeah, they're going to process you guys.
Yeah. We're in this lineup naked. You know what I mean? Yeah. Turn around. You know what I mean?
It's just, were like, you thinking about your dad?
Yeah. Yeah. That, to be honest, even worse than that humiliation was letting down my parents and them finally finding out what I'd been doing. Mm. And it just seemed unforgivable and so shameful at the time, you know? So yeah, it would just, you know, completely ruin their world.
What did they do? Like, what was that phone call? And what did they do?
To be honest, I tried to hide it from them, and they found out through a court paper that they sent to my permanent address,
right?
Which I think they knew what they were doing. I don't know. But they went to there and he was like, what the fuck is this?
Wow.
And so the jig was up. I finally had to tell them.
Wow.
But I was trying to hide it. You know what I mean?
First of all, do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child. And they put, you know, they immigrated over here with nothing, you know, worked their way, you know, cleaning, you know, people's houses and commercial buildings and fucking, you know, working at the chicken factory, you know what I mean? To try to give me a chance, a better chance than them. And then here's what I do. You know what I mean?
God.
So, yeah. So it was horrible. It was probably the worst, but at the same time, the best. I don't know if you can relate to that.
Yeah, I know what's coming because I know you're sober and you're doing well. But let me ask you, at that time, did you quit law school right away?
No, I made my way through. I thought I was going to rehabilitate myself, you know, because with rehabilitation, it's still weed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't kill anybody. I didn't rob a bank. You know what I'm saying? It's still, I got caught with selling weed.
Yeah.
So that was something that was, you know, you could rehabilitate from long as you show them you're sober and on the right path.
And you weren't an addict, or you were? I mean, I know you were doing a lot. Were you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I was a full-blown addict.
I see.
Yeah. I mean, do you call smoking weed every day, drinking 4 days a week, doing Molly whenever you could, doing cocaine whenever you could get your filthy little hands on it. An addict?
Yeah. Well, no, but it's interesting because there are different degrees of addiction, and you were functioning because you were going to law school.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say I was at the, you know, the middle advanced is what they called it, a treatment, you know, middle advanced stage of alcoholism.
Mm.
So, yeah. So I was, you know, probably it could get a lot worse. You know what I mean?
I have a child, one child, and I think about like everything you just told me, like what, mm-hmm. what my reaction would be. And what was your parents' reaction? I mean, not the minute they heard, but then, or just, yeah, walk me through how did they react?
Well, my dad was enraged, you know, as he often is. And then, well, you know, my mom probably just cried, you know, because I wasn't there, but I'm sure she just went in the room, you know, and cried about it. You know what I mean? Very uncomfortable conversation, but, you know, still, you know, trying to tell them, oh, it's still, you know, I could still do it. I just got to take a longer road and rehabilitate myself and I'll get sober and stuff like that, which, you know, sobriety didn't come for years after that.
So you did kind of get yourself back, you know, on track in terms of in school.
Yes.
So then third year of law school.
Yeah. I remember, I even went like on a fast and just, you know, sort of did it that way, you know, just like fasted for 3 days and, you know, stopped for a while. And then, you know, still going to school and stuff like that. But, I was just all about it, but I was already through the hardest part. They say the first year of school, they scare the shit out of you. Mm-hmm. The second year, they work the shit out of you. And then third year, they bore the shit out of you.
Wow.
So by the third year, I was sort of cruising, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'd not, you know, figured out how to study and all that stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Did you feel like you had an epiphany? Like, okay, it was the weed. That's what was wrong with me, that I wasn't on my path because of the weed. Now I'm really going to focus. I'm going to get into law. I know I will.
Like, that's exactly it. Yeah. Oh, that's exactly it. Shit. Yeah. No, I thought, yeah. And it was all it's my addiction, you know, it's my bad habit. And I didn't know about the program or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I thought everybody else was just trying to get off of DUIs and other court cases too when they went, you know?
Right.
And so I would go, but I didn't like buy into it. I thought I had enough strong will because my will had served me so far. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, sort of willed my way through law school, willed my way and, you know, did a lot of things.
Sure.
But when it came to my addiction, my will was useless.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So then when law school, it ended, or did you got through it? You got your degree. Did you take a bar exam?
I graduated, you know.
Did you take a bar somewhere?
That's the part that I'm getting to now is that I thought that I was gonna take the bar. But they have a committee. It's called the Character and Fitness Committee of the Bar Association. And they do a hearing for people that have committed felonies or other indiscrepancies and decide whether or not you have the character to sit for the bar, which is pretty hypocritical because I know, you know, half of them are a bunch of pot smoking, you know what I mean?
Alcoholics themselves. Plus, you already paid the money to go to law school.
Paid the money. Yeah, all right. Yeah, there's $200,000 at a private law school down the drain.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding. Yeah.
So they didn't let you take the test?
Yeah, well, they came back and said I was not fit. And at that time, I was sober for like, you know, I think like 2 years. And it sent me into a tailspin, you know?
Well, fuck yeah, you just worked your ass off.
Yeah, I relapsed because of it, everything, you know, and then went on a, like, you know, another binge, right? And then when I came down from that, I moved into my parents' house, back into my old room. There's the vision board that said Jimmy Shin, attorney at law, that I could look at. Which is still up there, by the way, and I look at it, laugh at it now. but yeah, how painful is that?
Like, that's really painful.
Yeah, I start selling cars.
So the 2 years you were binging, were you still living in San Diego and in Ocean Beach, and were you still? Did you go? How were you living?
Well, I moved back in Seattle. Hmm. You know, with a friend in his triplex. The guy who, you know. Is a multimillionaire now. Wow. You know, he took compassion on what I was going through. But anyway, then I moved into my parents' house.
Wow.
But fate would have it that they lived blocks away from the comedy place. It's called the Comedy Underground, Tacoma, Washington.
Yeah.
Every day I would drive by that thing, you know, I would drive by that thing and go, you know what? That would be interesting. Right. And one day I was depressed. My friend goes, hey, you want to check out an open mic? And I go, why not? I could use a laugh or two, right? So I go in there and some of them are really bad. And I'm thinking I could do better than these fuckers, mm-hmm. right? But I felt the energy of the room. You know, everyone was just having a good time. Other comedians supporting each other, you know, and laughing at each other's jokes, and sometimes not laughing at each other's jokes. But that's okay, right? That's part of it. And I wanted to be a part of it, man. And so the next week, you know, my friend goes, "You're gonna try it?" He goes, "You're funny, man. I think you could do this." And so, you know, it was almost like a dare, right? I go, okay, I'm going to get together some jokes and do it, you know? And the following week, I get together my jokes. You know, I don't think I was able to sleep the night before. And I don't even remember what I said because I kind of blacked out on stage. But I remember the way that I felt.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Like, this is it. This is what I want to do.
But was it because you got a laugh or was it because you had something to say?
I don't think I had anything profound to say or anything like that. It was a bunch of, you know, hacky jokes that I'd done in the past in front of friends at cocktail parties, you know, type of thing. But it was the way that I felt by making people laugh.
But the jokes weren't like personal about like, you know, so yeah, I'm here because I just finished law school or, you know what I mean?
No. It wasn't that deep yet. It was just like, one of my first jokes is, I want to come out like the, you know, Asian Justin Timberlake instead of NSYNC. I want to be NSYNC.
Oh, God. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So like very dated. And
that's funny though. That's funny because you say it.
These days you couldn't even say that, right? Like people get canceled for saying that.
Yeah, of course.
But even, you know, back then, that's the kind of thing that I did. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny. It is funny. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to laugh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I would kill with that set. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
And so I thought I was actually really, really good, right? Because you get those, you know, first responses. You're like, fuck, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, I want a tour, right?
Yeah, yeah. Did your parents know you were going down there?
Oh, no. They had no idea. You know, again, I live in a double life. You know, I kept a lot of things from them. And they also didn't really see me for me ever in my life. You know what I mean? See me for who I was. I was just a projection of, or an extension of them, you know, like if I become successful, they're successful.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Oh, my son is
a lawyer, right? My son, we made it because my son's a lawyer.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let me tell you, I'm banking on my daughter to buy me a house. No, I'm kidding. No, but I mean, I definitely get it. I mean, my focus is often on her world. Yeah. Of course. However, yeah. I have the background and I have the language to understand what she wants to do because I've lived in the United States, et cetera. You know what I mean? Your parents, they didn't know. They didn't have the ability to say, oh yeah, Jimmy, you should be a comic. I mean, it just seems preposterous, especially to think you're going to make money.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when I moved to LA, you know, my dad was the biggest thorn in my side. He would call me every day, like, why you no married? Why you no kids? You gay? And he knew I wasn't gay. He just wanted to get a rise out of me and manipulate me into coming back home and say, you know, you're never going to make it as a comedian in L.A., Asian people can't make it in Hollywood. Oh, yeah. All the time. Every day. And I would have to listen to it because sometimes I would need money to pay my rent, right? So I would have to listen to all his bullshit every day. But here's the turning point. He finally figured out Facebook and he sees that I'm doing it with all these big people and he can't deny it. He shows his friends and they're like, oh my God, Bill Burr. He's doing shows with Bill Burr. Your son made it. You know what I mean? Your son. So after about 100 of these people telling him that I actually made it, if I'm doing it with these people, right? And I'm making a living, right? How many people make a living doing this, right?
Yeah.
So, and so he sees that I don't need money anymore. He hasn't gotten a call in a few years. He figures out Facebook, sees all the posts, you know, on there. And now he's still comments in broken English. You are number one comedian in the world. Very handsome man. And lovely, handsome comedians. You know what I mean?
That is so sweet. I can't take it. And you have to. And do you say back? Well, you are the number one.
No. I thumbs up it so he gets that notification. Then I delete it because it gets embarrassing after about the 100th one because he writes the exact same thing. And so I delete it. And then, he gets that notification. So he hasn't figured out how to get on my profile yet.
Yeah.
To check if I deleted it.
How old is your dad?
He's like almost 80, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's old.
Yeah.
And so, but he figured out Facebook. You know, he's not, I know people that don't even want to fuck around with Facebook at that age.
Sure, sure. Do you think he actually kind of has a breakthrough about what artists are? I mean, in general, like, because sometimes when people get old, they soften. You know what I mean? They get a little kinder, a little sweeter. Like my dad would always say, whatever makes you happy, honey, as long as you're happy.
Well, it turned out he fucking wanted to kind of be a comedian or something. But he just never thought that it was possible, you know? And so when it became a reality to me, it showed that he was actually as proud as you could fucking possibly be. Yeah. It's almost annoying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's better than the former where he was telling me to move back home, right? Yeah. So it's in a positive direction, but it's still OCD and super like.
That's so, much. Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah. And how your parents have been married for like 50 years then?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. 45 years. And
Wow. That's terrific.
And so it's just crazy, right? And that it could turn around and it's just, you know, and I have to attribute it to my sobriety and my recovery. I did do that work of making amends and I did send that $100 check every month. And when he told me to stop sending it, I kept sending them. He would stop cashing them.
Wait, so I would still send them.
Because I owed them money from, I would call and say, hey, I need books again. He'd be like, books again. And I would use the money for drugs. And women and whatever, you know what I mean? And I wasn't using them for books.
So how much total money do you think they gave you in terms of that kind of cash you spent?
Maybe $100,000. Maybe $100,000. Yeah, easily $100,000. They say $1 million, but I don't know about $1 million.
That's so funny. Well, you know, I wonder, you know, at some point, hopefully you can buy them something. You know what I mean? Buy them something.
Let me get to that. when I got a fat check after doing a fat commercial, I bought my dad a car.
Oh, That's so great.
Drove the same beater, you know, for 20 years, you know what I mean? And so I've got him a car, and he called me up and he cried.
Oh.
And he cried and he said that he couldn't believe that I had bought him a car.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's part of the living amends, right? That's part of what we have to do to you know,
give back
and to give back, you
make
know,
a difference.
People forget about that part, you know, they think that I'm sorry, you know, yeah, anyone can say they're sorry,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing to say that you're sorry? You know what I mean? It's the action part, I think, that's so important and missing from a lot of people's amends. So they never get that feeling that we get when we make a true amends, right? You feel like you're floating. You feel like you had a spiritual experience, right?
That's so nice. I'm so glad that you've come, you know, full circle, and that your dad has been living and lived long enough to see this whole, you know what I mean? Because God, like, what if when you were going through that trouble, you know, in law school and drugs, I mean, what if, you know what I mean? Like, luckily, he's still with you. He got to see the whole thing, and your mom must be so proud of you.
Yeah. And let me end it with this. I experienced a miracle in August of 2019, right before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I did a show in my hometown, Tacoma, Washington, Tacoma Comedy Club. I finally decided to invite my parents because they have never seen me live. They've seen me on, you know, TV, on YouTube, stuff like that. But they never seen me live because I was always afraid that, you know, he would embarrass me. And plus, there was all that resentment, you know, that was built up. But now there was no resentment. And then during that time, I was trying to decide whether or not to invite them. And another friend of mine's mom had died. And she said she would give anything to hear her mom nag at her one more time. And so that just sort of gave me the change in perception that I needed to want to have no regrets. I don't want to be the guy that said, oh, I should have had my parents come out while they were alive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so definitely.
They bring 10 of their friends. Half of them don't even speak English. And I find out later they brought the 10 people because they didn't think anyone else was going to be there.
Oh, that is so sweet.
It was a sold out crowd. During my set, my dad stands up with an old fucking camcorder. He doesn't know he has a camera video on his phone. He brings and he starts filming me. The guy's like, you can't film in here, right? But he doesn't listen because he's my dad. He doesn't give a fuck, right? He's still the old stubborn guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's just sober now, right?
Sure.
So he doesn't stop filming. And what I realized is he was that proud of me.
That is so sweet.
He was proud of me to where he wanted to film me no matter what. And go watch that shit probably later.
Yeah. Oh, many times later, I'm sure. Yeah.
And it was just like, I couldn't believe that things had turned around that much, that God had worked in our lives to bring this sort of forgiveness and I don't know, just a lovely miracle into our lives.
A good story, man. It's a good story all in all. And then, and people must just eat you up on stage because they can tell how genuine you are and how you have walked the walk. And
everyone felt it, man. Everyone felt the energy of that day.
Wow. You know? That's really neat. That's really neat. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. By the way, have you ever been able to use any of your law school experience?
Oh, yeah. This is all part of my bit. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. But I mean, I meant practically the law. Like, have you ever been able to say, oh, no, don't do that because that's code such and such? Like,
No. I've never done that.
So all that stuff, all that 3 years, all that stuff, nobody ever said, where's your IRAC or whatever you said.
No, what I like to look at it, like, I don't look at it like a waste. What I look at it is it taught me how to think.
Yeah.
It taught me how to think reasonably and logically.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps me,
you
know, in my life, you know, in general.
Yeah.
You know, I don't just do things. I think like a lawyer. Like, how is this going to impact my audience? Right. How is this going to, you know, so it helps me. You know?
Yeah. That's good.
I've avoided being canceled many times because I pulled away from, something, doing something stupid.
Wow. Yeah, that's good stuff, man. Yeah, it's all really good stuff. I'm so happy for you. I really am. And I'm also very happy to have met Greg Baldwin. He is very good, and he's a great listener. And on your show that I was on, Second Chances, he asked very good questions. I don't have to tell you. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Here's how I met Greg. He would pick me up. I met him at a meeting.
I know this.
Yeah, La Cienega meeting. And my sponsor didn't want to give me a ride this time because I didn't have a car. Yeah. I had like a lot of people, I was down and out here in LA. I had relapsed in LA, and basically he started picking me up every day. And, you know, this is before he even knew that he wanted to or thought about being a comedian, you know? Yeah, one day he just came to my show and I go, "You want to try this?" That's literally how it started.
That's unbelievable. Well, that's how it started with you. Your friend said to you, "You want to go down to that club?" So,
yeah, I think all of us, right?
I guess I just feel like a lot of comedians, it's because there was a big break in their life. Like, you did have a big, you know, after the whole bus, I mean, there was a big break in your life.
Yeah, my other friend, Gary, did it right after a divorce.
Yeah, me too.
He didn't care anymore.
I went on stage with one joke, and I went on stage and I had 5 minutes of time at an open mic, and I had one joke. And that joke was, my husband just got another girl pregnant while we're married, and I'm flexible, but I'm not that flexible. And you know what? I actually did that joke two nights ago at Gotham. So it still works. And
Everyone loves those husband bashing jokes.
Well, he got another girl pregnant. Now there's a child.
You're not a superhero.
A lot of times. Right. So a lot of times it's like there is something serious that helps that pushes you up there that says, you know what? What's the difference? You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm going to say my truth and I'm going to say who I am and what's going on, whether you want to hear it or not. And I find it very funny, you know?
Yeah. And then after you fail out of law school and go to fucking jail and, you know what I mean? And ruin your parents' lives, you have nothing to lose.
God damn, that jail experience must have been just terrifying.
It was pretty traumatizing. I'm not going
to
lie.
Did you have to get a lawyer and stuff? Did you have to pay a lot of money?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all that. Yeah, that whole thing cost me so much money.
Yeah.
But thankfully, I'm making, you know, just as much money as a lawyer now, so.
Oh, well, that's a good way to look at it. I like that. Yeah. So I fought the law and the law won, or you won, something like that. You guys, check out more about Jimmy Shin over at his website, jimmyshindig.com. And also follow him on Twitter at I am Jimmy Shin, and follow Storyworthy over there as well, obviously at Storyworthy. All right. Thank you so much again, Jimmy. This is a great story. I'm really, really happy you came on. Thank you.
Yeah, I said some stuff I've never said before. You know, in my story. So, this is a great podcast.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it. And you guys, don't forget to check out Story Smash every Friday night on Facebook Live and YouTube every Friday night. Story Smash, the storytelling game show. Before we go back to the improv, don't miss it. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Jimmy Shin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com. I'll keep you safe.